Draco was screaming now.
You call that a warning when we're doing a ritual that calls for a permanent sacrifice? I...
The boy on the floor swallowed.
I guess maybe it wasn't clear. I'm sorry, but that which can be destroyed by the truth should be.
Hitting him wasn't enough.
You're wrong about one thing,
Draco said, his voice deadly.
Granger isn't the strongest student in Hogwarts. She just gets the best grades in class. You're about to find out the difference.
Sudden shock showed in Harry's face, and he tried to roll quickly to his feet. It was already too late for him.
Expelliarmus!
Harry's wand flew across the room.
Gomjabar!
A pulse of inky blackness struck Harry's left hand.
That's a torture spell,
said Draco.
It's for getting information out of people. I'm just going to leave it on you and lock the door behind me when I go. Maybe I'll set the lock spell to wear off after a few hours. Maybe it won't wear off until you die in here. Have fun.
Draco moved smoothly backward, wand still on Harry. Draco's hand dipped down and picked up his book bag without his aim wavering. The pain was already showing in Harry Potter's face as he spoke.
Malfoys are above the underage magic laws, I take it. It's not because your blood is stronger, it's because you already practiced. In the beginning, you were as weak as any of us. Is my prediction wrong?
Draco's hand whitened on his wand, but his aim stayed steady.
Just so you know,
Harry said through gritted teeth,
if you'd told me I was wrong, I would have listened. I won't ever torture you when you show me that I'm wrong. And you will. Someday, you're awakened as a scientist now, and even if you never learn to use your power, you'll always...
Harry gasped.
Be looking for ways to test your beliefs.
Draco's backing away was less smooth, now a little faster, and he had to work to keep his wand on Harry as he reached back to open the door and stepped back out of the classroom. Then Draco shut the door again. He cast the most powerful locking charm he knew. Draco waited until he heard Harry's first scream before casting the quietus. And then he walked away.
Yeah! Fine-eyed incantatum!
Harry's left hand had been put into a pot of boiling cooking oil and left there. He'd put everything he had into the finite incantatum, and it still wasn't working. Some hexes required specific counters or you couldn't undo them. Or maybe it was just that Draco was that much stronger. Harry's hand was really starting to hurt now, and that was interfering with his attempts to think creatively. But a few screams later, Harry realized what he had to do. His pouch, unfortunately, was on the wrong side of his body, and it took some twisting to reach into it, especially with his other arm flailing around in a reflexive, unstoppable attempt to fling off the source of pain. By the time he managed it, his other arm had managed to throw away his wand again.
Medical! Kid! Medical kid!
On the floor, the green light was too dim to see by. Harry couldn't stand. He couldn't crawl. He rolled across the floor to where he thought his wand was, and it wasn't there. and with one hand he managed to raise himself high enough to see his wand, and he rolled there, and got the wand, and rolled back to where the medical kit was opened. There was also a good deal of screaming and a bit of throwing up. It took 8 tries before Harry could cast Lumos. And then, well, the package wasn't designed to be opened one-handed, because all wizards were idiots. That was why. Harry had to use his teeth, and so it took a while before Harry finally managed to wrap the numb cloth over his left hand. When all feeling in his left hand was finally gone, Harry let his mind come apart, and lay motionless on the floor, and cried for a while. "Well," Harry's mind said silently to itself, when it had recovered enough to think in words again, "was it worth it?" Slowly, Harry's functional hand reached up to a desk. Harry pulled himself to his feet, took a deep breath, exhaled, smiled. It wasn't much of a smile, but it was a smile nonetheless.
"Thank you, Professor Quirrell. I couldn't have lost without you."
He hadn't redeemed Draco yet. Not even close. Contrary to what Draco himself might now believe, Draco was still the child of a Death Eater, through and through. Still a boy who'd grown up to think rape was something the cool older kids did. But it was one heck of a start. Harry couldn't claim it had all gone just as planned. It had all gone just as completely made up on the spot. The plan hadn't called for this to happen until December, or thereabouts, after Harry had taught Draco the techniques not to deny the evidence when he saw it. But he'd seen the look of fear on Draco's face, realized that Draco was already taking an alternative hypothesis seriously, and seized the moment. One case of true curiosity had the same sort of redeeming power in rationality that one case of true love had in movies. In retrospect, Harry had given himself hours to make the most important discovery in the history of magic, and months to break through the undeveloped mental barriers of an 11-year-old boy. This could indicate that Harry had some sort of major cognitive deficit with respect to estimating task completion times. Was Harry going to science hell for what he'd done? Harry wasn't sure. He'd contrived to keep Draco's mind on the possibility that magic was fading, made sure Draco would carry out the part of the experiment that would seem at first to point in that direction. He'd waited until after explaining genetics to prompt Draco into realizing about magical creatures, though Harry had thought in terms of ancient artifacts like the Sorting Hat, which no one could duplicate anymore, but which continued to function. But Harry hadn't actually exaggerated any evidence, hadn't distorted the meaning of any results. When the Interdict of Merlin had invalidated the tests that should have been definitive, he'd told Draco up front. And then there was the part after that. But he hadn't actually lied to Draco. Draco had believed it. And that would make it true. The end, admittedly, had not been fun. Harry turned and staggered toward the door. Time to test Draco's locking spell. The first step was simply trying to turn the doorknob. Draco could have been bluffing. Draco hadn't been bluffing.
"Finite incantatum!"
Harry's voice came out rather hoarse, and he could feel that the spell hadn't taken. So Harry tried again, and that time it felt true. But another twist at the doorknob showed it hadn't worked. No surprise there. Time to bring out the big guns. Harry drew a deep breath. This spell was one of the most powerful he'd learned so far.
"Aloha Mora!"
Harry staggered a little after saying it, and The classroom door still didn't open. That shocked Harry. Harry hadn't been planning to go anywhere near Dumbledore's forbidden corridor, of course, but a spell to open magical locks had seemed like a useful sort of spell anyway, and so Harry had learned it. Was Dumbledore's forbidden corridor meant to lure people so stupid they didn't notice the security was worse than what Draco Malfoy could put on it? Fear was creeping back into Harry's system. The placard in the medical kit said the numb cloth could only safely be used for up to 30 minutes. After that it would come off automatically and not be reusable for 24 hours. Right now it was 6:51 p.m. He'd put on the numb cloth about 5 minutes ago. So Harry took a step back and considered the door. It was a solid panel of dark oaken wood, interrupted only by the brass metal doorknob. Harry didn't know any explosive or cutting or smashing spells, and transfiguring explosives would have violated the rule against transfiguring things to be burned. Acid was a liquid and would have made fumes, but that was no obstacle to a creative thinker. Harry laid his wand against one of the door's brass hinges and concentrated on the form of cotton as a pure abstraction apart from any material cotton, and also on the pure material apart from the pattern that made it a brass hinge, and brought the two concepts together, imposing shape on substance. An hour of transfiguration practice every day for a month had gotten Harry to the point where he could transfigure a subject of 5 cubic centimetres in just under a minute. After 2 minutes, the hinge hadn't changed at all. Whoever had designed Draco's locking spell, they'd thought of that too. Or the door was part of Hogwarts and the castle was immune. A glance showed the walls to be solid stone. So was the floor. So was the ceiling. You couldn't separately transfigure a part of something that was a solid whole. Harry would have needed to try transfiguring the whole wall, which would have taken hours, or maybe days of continuous effort, if he could have done it at all, and if the wall wasn't contiguous with the rest of the whole castle. Harry's time-turner wouldn't open until 9 p.m. After that, he could go back to 6 p.m. before the door was locked. How long would the torture spell last? Harry swallowed hard. Tears were coming into his eyes again. His brilliantly creative mind had just offered the ingenious suggestion that Harry could cut his hand off using the hacksaw in the toolset stored in his pouch, which would hurt, obviously, but might hurt a lot less than Draco's pain spell, since the nerves would be gone, and he had tourniquets in the healer's kit. And that was obviously a hideously stupid idea that Harry would regret the rest of his entire life. But Harry didn't know if he could hold out for 2 hours under torture. He wanted out of this classroom. He wanted out of this classroom now. He didn't want to wait in here screaming for 2 hours until he could use the time-turner. He needed to get out and find someone to get the torture spell off his hand.
Think!
Harry screamed at his brain.
Think! Think!
The Slytherin dorm was mostly empty. People were at dinner. For some reason, Draco himself wasn't feeling very hungry. Draco closed the door to his private room, locked it, charmed it shut, quieted it, sat down on his bed, and started to cry. It wasn't fair. It wasn't fair. It was the first time Draco had ever really lost before. Father had warned him that losing for real would hurt the first time it happened, but he'd lost so much. It wasn't fair. It wasn't fair for him to lose everything the first time he lost. somewhere in the dungeons, a boy Draco had actually liked was screaming in pain. Draco had never heard anyone he'd liked before. Punishing people who deserved it was supposed to be fun, but this just felt sick inside. Father hadn't warned him about that, and Draco wondered if it was a hard lesson everyone had to learn when they grew up, or if Draco was just weak. Draco wished it were Pansy screaming. That would have felt better. And the worst part was knowing that it might have been a mistake to hurt Harry Potter. Who else was there for Draco now? Dumbledore? After what he had done, Draco would sooner have been burned alive. Draco would have to go back to Harry Potter because there was nowhere else for him to go. And if Harry Potter said he didn't want him, then Draco would be nothing. Just a pathetic little boy who could never be a Death Eater. Never join Dumbledore's faction. Never learn science. The trap had been perfectly set. Perfectly executed. Father had warned Draco over and over that what you sacrificed to dark rituals couldn't be regained. But Father hadn't known that the accursed muggles had invented rituals that didn't need wands. Rituals you could be tricked into doing without knowing it. And that was only one of the terrible secrets which scientists knew and which Harry Potter had brought with him. Draco started crying harder then. He didn't want this. He didn't want this. But there was no turning back. It was too late. He was already a scientist. Draco knew he should go back and free Harry Potter and apologize. It would have been the smart thing to do. Instead, Draco stayed in his bed and sobbed. He'd already hurt Harry Potter. It might be the only time Draco ever got to hurt him, and he would have to hold to that one memory for the rest of his life. Let him keep screaming. Harry dropped the remnants of his hacksaw to the ground. The brass hinges had proved impervious, not even scratched, and Harry was beginning to suspect that even the desperate act of trying to transfigure acid or explosives would have failed to open this door. On the plus side, the attempt had destroyed the hacksaw. His watch said it was 7:02 p.m. with less than 15 minutes left, and Harry tried to remember if there was any other sharp things in his pouch that needed destroying, and felt another fit of tears welling up. If only, when his time turner opened, he could go back and prevent... And that was when Harry realized he was being silly. It wasn't the first time he'd been locked in a room. Professor McGonagall had already told him the correct way to do this. She'd also told him not to use the time-turner for this sort of thing. Would Professor McGonagall realize that this occasion really did warrant a special exception? Or just take away the time-turner entirely? Harry gathered up all his things, all the evidence into his pouch. Scorchify took care of the vomit on the floor, though not the sweat that had soaked his robes. He left the overturned desks overturned. It wasn't important enough to be worth doing with one hand. When he was done, Harry glanced down at his watch. 7:04 p.m. And then Harry waited. Seconds passed, feeling like years. At 7:07 p.m., the door opened. Professor Flitwick's puff-bearded face looked rather concerned.
"Are you all right, Harry?"
said the squeaky voice of Ravenclaw's head of house.
"I got a note saying you'd been locked in here."
Chapter 24. Machiavellian Intelligence Hypothesis. Act 3. Draco waited in a small windowed alcove he'd found near the Great Hall, stomach churning. There would be a price, and it would not be small. Draco had known that as soon as he'd woken up and realized that he didn't dare enter the Great Hall for breakfast because he might see Harry Potter there, and Draco didn't know what would happen after that. Footsteps approached.
"Here you go," said Vincent's voice. "Now, the boss ain't in a good mood today, so you'd better watch your step."
Draco was going to skin that idiot alive and send back the flayed body with a request for a more intelligent servant, like a dead gerbil. One set of footsteps went off, and the other set of footsteps came closer. The churning in Draco's stomach got worse. Harry Potter came into sight. His face was carefully neutral, but his blue-trimmed robes looked oddly askew, as if they hadn't been put on quite right.
"Your hand,"
Draco said without thinking about it at all. Harry raised his left arm as though to look at it himself. The hand dangled limply from it, like something dead.
"Madam Pomfrey said it's not permanent,"
Harry said quietly.
"She said it would mostly recover by the time classes started tomorrow."
For a single instant, the news came as a relief, and then Draco realized.
"You went to Madam Pomfrey?" whispered Draco.
"Of course I did,"
said Harry Potter, as though stating the obvious.
"My hand wasn't working."
It was slowly dawning on Draco what an absolute fool he had been. Far worse than the older Slytherins he'd chewed out. He had just taken for granted that no one would go to the authorities when a Malfoy did something to them. That no one would want Lucius Malfoy's eye on them, ever. But Harry Potter wasn't a frightened little Hufflepuff trying to stay out of the game. He was already playing it, and Father's eye was already on him.
"What else did Madame Pomfrey say?"
said Draco, his heart in his throat.
"Professor Flitwick said that the spell cast on my hand had been a dark torture hex and extremely serious business, and that refusing to say who did it was absolutely unacceptable."
There was a long pause.
"And then?"
Draco said in a shaking voice. Harry Potter smiled slightly.
"I apologized deeply, which made Professor Flitwick look very stern. And then I told Professor Flitwick that the whole thing was, indeed, extremely serious. Secret, delicate business, and that I'd already informed the headmaster about the project."
Draco gasped.
"No, Flitwick isn't going to just accept that. He'll check with Dumbledore."
"Indeed,"
said Harry Potter.
"I was promptly hauled off to the headmaster's office."
Draco was trembling now. If Dumbledore brought Harry Potter before the Wizengamot, willingly or otherwise, and had the boy who lived testify under Veritaserum that Draco had tortured him... Too many people loved Harry Potter. Father could lose that vote. Father might be able to convince Dumbledore not to do that, but it would cost terribly. The game had rules now. You couldn't just threaten someone at random anymore. But Draco had walked into Dumbledore's hands of his own free will. And Draco was a very valuable hostage. Though, since Draco couldn't be a Death Eater now, he wasn't as valuable as Father thought. The thought tore at his heart like a cutting charm.
"Then what?"
whispered Draco.
"Dumbledore deduced immediately that it was you. He knew we'd been associating."
The worst possible scenario. If Dumbledore hadn't guessed who did it, he might not have risked using legitimacy just to find out. But if Dumbledore knew...
And?
Draco forced out the word.
We had a little chat. And?
Harry Potter grinned.
And I explained that it would be in his best interest not to do anything.
Draco's mind ran into a brick wall and splattered. He just stared at Harry Potter with his mouth hanging slack like a fool. It took that long for Draco to remember. Harry knew Dumbledore's mysterious secret, the one Snape used as his hold. Draco could just see it now. Dumbledore looking all stern, concealing his eagerness as he explained to Harry what a terribly serious matter this was. And Harry politely telling Dumbledore to keep his mouth shut if he knew what was good for him. Father had warned Draco against people like this, people who could ruin you and still be so likable that it was hard to hate them properly.
After which, Harry said, the headmaster told Professor Flitwick that this was indeed a secret and delicate matter of which he had already been informed, and that he did not think pressing it at this time would help me or anyone. Professor Flitwick started to say something about the headmaster's usual plotting going much too far, and I had to interrupt at that point and explain that it had been my own idea, and not anything the headmaster forced me into. So, Professor Flitwick spun around and started lecturing me, and the headmaster interrupted him and said that, as the boy who lived, I was doomed to have weird and dangerous adventures, so I was safer if I got into them on purpose instead of waiting for them to happen by accident. And that was when Professor Flitwick threw up his little hands and started shrieking in a high-pitched voice at both of us about how he didn't care what we were cooking up together, but this wasn't ever to happen again for as long as I was in Ravenclaw House, or he would have me thrown out, and I could go to Gryffindor, which was where all this Dumbledoring belonged.
Harry was making it very hard for Draco to hate him.
Anyway,
Harry said,
I didn't want to be thrown out of Ravenclaw, so I promised Professor Flitwick that nothing like this would happen again, and if it did, I would just tell him who did it.
Harry's eyes should have been cold. They weren't. The voice should have made it a deadly threat. It wasn't. And Draco saw the question that should have been obvious, and it killed the mood in an instant.
Why didn't you?
Harry walked over to the window, into the small beam of sunlight shining into the alcove, and turned his head outward, toward the green grounds of Hogwarts. The brightness shone on him, on his robes, on his face.
Why didn't I?
Harry said, his voice caught.
I guess because I just couldn't get angry at you. I knew I'd hurt you first. I won't even call it fair, because what I did to you was worse than what you did to me.
It was like running into another brick wall. Harry could have been speaking archaic Greek for all Draco understood him then. Draco's mind scrabbled for patterns that came up flat blank. The statement was a concession that hadn't been in Harry's best interests. It wasn't even what Harry should say to make Draco a more loyal servant now that Harry had power over him. For that, Harry should be emphasizing how kindly he'd been, not how much he'd hurt Draco.
Even so,
Harry said, and now his voice was lower, almost a whisper,
please, don't do that again, Draco. It hurt, and I'm not sure I could forgive you a second time. I'm not sure I'd be able to want to.
Draco just didn't get it. Was Harry trying to be friends with him? There was no way Harry Potter could be dumb enough to believe that was still possible after what he had done. You could be someone's friend and ally, like Draco had tried to do with Harry, or you could destroy their life and leave them no other options. Not both. But then Draco didn't understand what else Harry could be trying. And a strange thought came to Draco then, something Harry had kept talking about yesterday. And the thought was, test it. "You're awakened as a scientist now," Harry had said, "and even if you never learn to use your power, you'll always be looking for ways to test your beliefs." Those ominous words, spoken in gasps of agony, had kept running through Draco's mind. If Harry was pretending to be the repentant friend who had accidentally hurt someone...
"You planned what you did to me," Draco said, managing to put a note of accusation in his voice. "You didn't do it because you got angry. You did it because you wanted to."
"Fool," Harry Potter would say. "Of course I planned it, and now you're mine."
Harry turned back toward Draco.
What happened yesterday wasn't the plan,"
Harry said, his voice seeming stuck in his throat.
"The plan was that I would teach you why you were always better off knowing the truth, and then we would try together to discover the truth about blood, and whatever the answer was, we would accept it. Yesterday, I rushed things."
"Always better off knowing the truth," Draco said coldly. "Like you did me a favour."
Harry nodded, blowing Draco's mind completely, and said,
"What if Lucius comes up with the same idea I did, that the problem is stronger wizards having fewer children? He might start a program to pay the strongest purebloods to have more children. In fact, if blood purism were right, that's just what Lucius should be doing. Addressing the problem on his side, where he can make things happen right away. Right now, Draco, you're the only friend Lucius has who would try to stop him from wasting the effort, because you're the only one who knows the real truth and can predict the real results."
The thought came to Draco that Harry Potter had been raised in a place so strange that he was now effectively a magical creature rather than a wizard. Draco simply couldn't guess what Harry would say or do next.
"Why?"
Draco said. Putting pain and betrayal into his voice wasn't hard at all.
"Why did you do this to me? What was your plan?"
"Well," Harry said, "you're Lucius's heir, and, believe it or not, Dumbledore thinks I belong to him. So we could grow up and fight their battles with each other. Or we could do something else."
Slowly, Draco's mind wrapped around this.
"You want to provoke a fight to the finish between them, then seize power after they're both exhausted?"
Draco felt cold dread in his chest. He would have to try and stop that, no matter the cost to himself. But Harry shook his head.
"Stars above, no!
No,
you wouldn't go along with that, and neither would I,"
said Harry.
"This is our world. We don't want to break it. But imagine, say, Lucius thought the conspiracy was your tool, and you were on his side. Dumbledore thought the conspiracy was my tool, and I was on his side. Lucius thought that you'd turned me, and Dumbledore believed the conspiracy was mine. Dumbledore thought that I'd turned you, and Lucius believed the conspiracy was yours. And so they both helped us out, but only in ways that the other one wouldn't notice."
Draco didn't have to fake being speechless. Father had once taken him to see a play called The Tragedy of Light, about this incredibly clever Slytherin named Light, who'd set out to purify the world of evil using an ancient ring that could kill anyone whose name and face he knew, and who'd been opposed by another incredibly clever Slytherin, a villain named Lawleet, who'd worn a disguise to conceal his true face. And Draco had shouted and cheered at all the right parts, especially in the middle. And then the play had ended sadly, and Draco had been hugely disappointed, and Father had gently pointed out that the word tragedy was right there in the title. Afterward, Father had asked Draco if he understood why they had gone to see this play. Draco had said it was to teach him to be as cunning as Light and Lawleet when he grew up. Father had said that Draco couldn't possibly be more wrong, and pointed out that while Lawleet had cleverly concealed his face, there had been no good reason for him to tell Light his name. Father had then gone on to demolish almost every part of the play, while Draco listened with his eyes growing wider and wider. And Father had finished by saying that plays like this were always unrealistic, because if the playwright had known what someone actually as smart as Light would actually do, the playwright would have tried to take over the world himself, instead of just writing plays about it. That was when Father had told Draco about the rule of three, which was that any plot which required more than three different things to happen would never work in real life. Father had further explained that since only a fool would attempt a plot that was as complicated as possible, the real limit was two. Draco couldn't even find words to describe the sheer, gargantuan unworkability of Harry's master plan. But it was just the sort of mistake you'd make if you didn't have any mentors and thought you were clever and had learned about plotting by watching plays.
"So," said Harry, "what do you think of the plan?"
"It's clever,"
Draco said slowly. Shouting "brilliant" and gasping in awe would have looked too suspicious.
"Harry, can I ask a question?"
Sure,
said Harry.
"Why did you buy Granger an expensive pouch?"
"To show no hard feelings," said Harry at once. "Though I expect she'd also feel awkward if she refuses any small requests I make over the next couple of months."
And that was when Draco realized that Harry actually was trying to be his friend. Harry's move against Granger had been smart, maybe even brilliant. Make your enemy not suspect you, and put them into your debt in a friendly way so that you could maneuver them into position just by asking them. Draco couldn't have gotten away with that. His target would have been too suspicious. But the boy who lived could. So, the first step of Harry's plot was to give his enemy an expensive present. Draco wouldn't have thought of that, but it could work. If you were Harry's enemy, his plots might be hard to see through at first. They might even be stupid. But his reasoning would make sense. Once you understood it, you would comprehend that he was trying to hurt you. The way Harry was acting toward Draco right now did not make sense. Because if you were Harry's friend, then he tried to be friends with you in the alien, incomprehensible way that he had been raised by Muggles to do, even if it meant destroying your entire life. The silence stretched.
"I know that I've abused our friendship terribly," Harry said finally. "But please realize, Draco, that in the end, I just wanted the two of us to find the truth together. Is that something you can forgive?"
A fork with two paths, but with only one path easy to go back on later if Draco changed his mind. I guess I can understand what you were trying to do, Draco lied. So, yes. Harry's eyes lit up.
I'm glad to hear that, Draco, he said softly.
The two students stood in that alcove, Harry still dipped in the lone sunbeam, Draco in shadow. And Draco realized, with a note of horror and despair, that although it was a terrifying fate indeed to be Harry's friend, Harry now had so many different avenues for threatening Draco that being his enemy would be even worse.
Probably.
Maybe. Well, he could always switch to being enemies later.
He was doomed.
So, Draco said,
now what? We study again, next Saturday?
It better not go like the last one.
Don't worry, it won't, said Harry. A few more Saturdays like that and you'd be ahead of me.
Harry laughed. Draco didn't.
Oh, and before you go,
Harry said, and grinned sheepishly,
I know this is a bad time, but I wanted to ask you for advice about something, actually.
Okay, Draco said, still a bit distracted by that last statement. Harry's eyes grew intent.
Buying that pouch for Granger used up most of the gold I managed to steal from my Gringotts vault.
What?
And McGonagall has the vault key, or Dumbledore does now, maybe, and I was just about to launch a plot that might take some money, so I was wondering if you know how to get access...
I'll loan you the money, said Draco's mouth in sheer existential reflex. Harry looked taken aback, but in a pleased way.
Draco, you don't have to...
How much? Harry named the amount, and Draco couldn't quite keep the shock from showing on his face. That was almost all the spending money Father had given Draco to last out the whole year. Draco would be left with just a few galleons. Then Draco mentally kicked himself. All he had to do was write Father and explain that the money was gone because he had managed to loan it to Harry Potter, and Father would send him a special congratulatory note written in golden ink, a giant chocolate frog that would take 2 weeks to eat, and 10 times as many galleons just in case Harry Potter needed another loan.
It's way too much, isn't it? Said Harry. I'm sorry, I shouldn't have asked.
Excuse me, I am a Malfoy, you know, said Draco. I was just surprised you wanted that much.
Don't worry,
Harry Potter said cheerfully.
It's nothing that threatens your family's interests, just me being evil.
Draco nodded. No problem, then. You want to go get it right now?
Sure,
said Harry. As they left the alcove and started heading toward the dungeons, Draco couldn't help but ask.
So, can you tell me which plot this is for?
Rita Skeeter.
Draco thought some very bad words to himself, but it was far too late to say no. By the time they'd reached the dungeons, Draco had started pulling together his thoughts again. He was having trouble hating Harry Potter. Harry had been trying to be friendly. He was just insane. And that wasn't going to stop Draco's revenge or even slow it down.
So,
Draco said after looking around to make certain no one was nearby. Their voices would both be blurred, of course, but it never hurt to be extra sure.
I've been thinking. When we bring new recruits into the conspiracy, they're going to have to think we're equals. Otherwise, it would only take one of them to blow the plot to Father. You already worked that out, right?
Naturally, said Harry. Will we be equals?
Said Draco.
I'm afraid not, Harry said.
It was clear that he was trying to sound gentle, and also clear that he was trying to suppress a good deal of condescension and not quite succeeding.
I'm sorry, Draco, but you don't even know what the word Bayesian in Bayesian conspiracy means right now. You're going to have to study for months before we can take anyone else in, just so you can put up a good front. Because I don't know enough science,
Draco said, carefully keeping his voice neutral. Harry shook his head at that.
The problem isn't that you're ignorant of specific science things like deoxyribonucleic acid. That wouldn't stop you from being my equal. The problem is that you aren't trained in the methods of rationality, the deeper, secret knowledge behind how all those discoveries got made in the first place. I'll try to teach you those, but they're a lot harder to learn. Think of what we did yesterday, Draco. Yes, you did some of the work, but I was the only one in control. You answered some of the questions. I asked all of them. You helped push. I did the steering by myself. And without the methods of rationality, Draco, you can't possibly steer the conspiracy where it needs to go.
I see, said Draco, voice sounding disappointed. Harry's voice tried to gentle itself up even more.
I'll try to respect your expertise, Draco, about things like people stuff. But you need to respect my expertise, too. And there's just no way you could be my equal when it comes to steering the conspiracy. You've only been a scientist for one day. You know one secret about deoxyribonucleic acid, and you aren't trained in any of the methods of rationality.
I understand, said Draco. And he did. People stuff, Harry had said. Seizing control of the conspiracy probably wouldn't even be difficult. And afterward, he would kill Harry Potter, just to be sure. The memory rose up in Draco of how sick inside it had felt last night, knowing Harry was screaming. Draco thought some bad words. Fine, he wouldn't kill Harry. Harry had been raised by muggles. It wasn't his fault he was insane. Instead, Harry would live on, just so that Draco could tell him that it had all been for Harry's own good, really. He ought to be grateful. And with a sudden twitch of surprised pleasure, Draco realized that it actually was for Harry's own good. If Harry tried to carry out his plan of playing Dumbledore and Father for Fools, he would die. That made it perfect. Draco would take all of Harry's dreams away from him, just as Harry had done to him. Draco would tell Harry that it had been for his own good, and it would be absolutely true. Draco would wield the conspiracy and the power of science to purify the wizarding world, and Father would be as proud of him as if he had been a Death Eater. Harry Potter's evil plots would be foiled, and the forces of right would prevail. Perfect revenge.
Unless... Just pretend to be pretending to be a scientist,
Harry had told him. Draco didn't have words to describe exactly what was wrong with Harry's mind, since Draco had never heard the term depth of recursion, but he could guess what sort of plots it implied.
Unless... All that was exactly what Harry wanted Draco to do as part of some even larger plot which Draco would play right into by trying to foil this one. Harry might even know that his plan was unworkable,
It might have no purpose except luring Draco to thwart it. No, that way lay madness. There had to be a limit. The Dark Lord himself hadn't been that twisty. That sort of thing didn't happen in real life, only in Father's silly bedtime stories about foolish gargoyles who always ended up furthering the hero's plans every time they tried to stop him. And, beside Draco, Harry walked along with a smile on his face, thinking about the evolutionary origins of human intelligence. In the beginning, before people had quite understood how evolution worked, they'd gone around thinking crazy ideas like human intelligence evolved so that we could invent better tools. The reason why this was crazy was that only one person in the tribe had to invent a tool, and then everyone else would use it, and it would spread to other tribes and still be used by their descendants 100 years later. That was great from the perspective of scientific progress, but in evolutionary terms it meant that the person who invented something didn't have much of a fitness advantage, didn't have all that many more children than everyone else. Only relative fitness advantages could increase the relative frequency of a gene in the population and drive some lonely mutation to the point where it was universal and everyone had it. And brilliant inventions just weren't common enough to provide the sort of consistent selection pressure it took to promote a mutation. It was a natural guess, if you looked at humans with their guns and tanks and nuclear weapons and compared them to chimpanzees, that the intelligence was there to make the technology. A natural guess, but wrong. Before people had quite understood how evolution worked, they'd gone around thinking crazy ideas like the climate changed and tribes had to migrate and people had to become smarter in order to solve all the novel problems. But human beings had 4 times the brain size of a chimpanzee. 20% of a human's metabolic energy went into feeding the brain. Humans were ridiculously smarter than any other species. That sort of thing didn't happen because the environment stepped up the difficulty of its problems a little. Then the organisms would just get a little smarter to solve them, ending up with a gigantic outsized brain must have taken some sort of runaway evolutionary process, something that would push and push without limits. And today's scientists had a pretty good guess at what that runaway evolutionary process had been. Harry had once read a famous book called Chimpanzee Politics. The book had described how an adult chimpanzee named Lute had confronted the aging alpha Jeroen with the help of a young, recently matured chimpanzee named Nicky. Nicky had not intervened directly in the fights between Lute and Jeroen, but had prevented Jeroen's other supporters in the tribe from coming to his aid, distracting them whenever a confrontation developed between Lute and Jeroen. And in time, Lute had won and become the new alpha, with Nicky as the second most powerful. Though it hadn't taken very long after that for Nicky to form an alliance with the defeated Jeroen, overthrow Lute, and become the new alpha. It really made you appreciate what millions of years of hominids trying to outwit each other, an evolutionary arms race without limit, had led to in the way of increased mental capacity. 'Cause, you know, a human would have totally seen that one coming. And beside Harry, Draco walked along, suppressing his smile as he thought about his revenge. Someday, maybe in years, but someday, Harry Potter would learn just what it meant to underestimate a Malfoy. Draco had awakened as a scientist in a single day. Harry had said that wasn't supposed to happen for months. But of course, if you were a Malfoy, you would be a more powerful scientist than anyone who wasn't. So Draco would learn all of Harry Potter's methods of rationality. And when the time was ripe. Chapter 25. Hold off on proposing solutions. Act 2. The sun shone brightly into the great hall from the enchanted sky ceiling above, illuminating the students as though they sat beneath the naked sky, gleaming from their plates and bowls, as, refreshed by a night's sleep, they inhaled breakfast in preparation for whatever plans they'd made for their Sunday. So, there was only one thing that made you a wizard. That wasn't surprising when you thought about it. What DNA mostly did was tell ribosomes how to chain amino acids together into proteins. Conventional physics seemed quite capable of describing amino acids, and no matter how many amino acids you chained together, conventional physics said you would never, ever get magic out of it. And yet, magic seemed to be hereditary, following DNA. Then, that probably wasn't because the DNA was chaining together non-magical amino acids into magical proteins. Rather, the key DNA sequence did not, of itself, give you your magic at all. Magic came from somewhere else. At the Ravenclaw table, there was one boy who was staring off into space, as his right hand automatically spooned some unimportant food into his mouth from whatever was in front of him. You probably could have substituted a pile of dirt, and he wouldn't have noticed. And, for some reason, the source of magic was paying attention to a particular DNA marker among individuals who were ordinary ape-descended humans in every other way. Actually, there were quite a lot of boys and girls staring off into space. It was the Ravenclaw table, after all. There were other lines of logic leading to the same conclusion. Complex machinery was always universal within a sexually reproducing species. If Gene B relied on Gene A, then Gene A had to be useful on its own, and rise to near universality in the gene pool on its own, before B would be useful often enough to confer a fitness advantage. Then, once B was universal, you would get a variant A star that relied on B, and then C that relied on A star, and B, then B star that relied on C, until the whole machine would fall apart if you removed a single piece. But it all had to happen incrementally. Evolution never looked ahead. Evolution would never start promoting B in preparation for A becoming universal later. Evolution was the simple historical fact that whichever organism did, in fact, have the most children, their genes would, in fact, be more frequent in the next generation. So, each piece of a complex machine had to become nearly universal before other pieces in the machine would evolve to depend on its presence. So, complex interdependent machinery, the powerful, sophisticated protein machines that drove life, was always universal within a sexually reproducing species, except for a small handful of non-interdependent variants that were being selected on at any given time as further complexity was slowly laid down. It was why all human beings had the same underlying brain design, the same emotions, the same facial expressions wired up to those emotions. Those adaptations were complex, so they had to be universal. If magic had been like that, a big, complex adaptation with lots of necessary genes, then a wizard mating with a muggle would have resulted in a child with only half those parts, and half the machine wouldn't do much. And so there would have been no muggleborns, ever. Even if all the pieces had individually gotten into the muggle gene pool, they'd never reassemble all in one place to form a wizard. There hadn't been some genetically isolated valley of humans that had stumbled onto an evolutionary pathway leading to sophisticated magical sections of the brain. That complex genetic machinery, if wizards interbred with muggles, would never have reassembled into muggleborns. So, however your genes made you a wizard, it wasn't by containing the blueprints for complicated machinery. That was the other reason Harry had guessed the Mendelian pattern would be there. If magical genes weren't complicated, why would there be more than one? And yet, magic itself seemed pretty complicated. A door-locking spell would prevent the door from opening, and prevent you from transfiguring the hinges, and resist finite incantatum and Alohomora. Many elements, all pointing in the same direction. You could call that goal orientation, or in simpler language, purposefulness. There were only two known causes of purposeful complexity. Natural selection, which produced things like butterflies, and intelligent engineering, which produced things like cars. Magic didn't seem like something that had self-replicated into existence. Spells were purposefully complicated, but not, like a butterfly, complicated for the purpose of making copies of themselves. Spells were complicated for the purpose of serving their user, like a car. Some intelligent engineer, then, had created the source of magic and told it to pay attention to a particular DNA marker. The obvious next thought was that this had something to do with Atlantis. Harry had asked Hermione about that earlier, on the train to Hogwarts, after hearing Draco say it, and so far as she knew, nothing more was known than the word itself. It might have been pure legend, but it was also plausible enough that a civilization of magic users, especially one from before the interdict of Merlin, would have managed to blow itself up. The line of reasoning continued. Atlantis had been an isolated civilization that had somehow brought into being the source of magic, and told it to serve only people with the Atlantean genetic marker, the blood of Atlantis. And, by similar logic, the words a wizard spoke, the wand movements, those weren't complicated enough of themselves to build up the spell effects from scratch, not the way that the 3 billion base pairs of human DNA actually were complicated enough to build a human body from scratch, not the way that computer programs took up thousands of bytes of data. So, the words and wand movements were just triggers, levers pulled on some hidden and more complex machine. Buttons, not blueprints. And, just like a computer program wouldn't compile if you made a single spelling error, the source of magic wouldn't respond to you unless you cast your spells in exactly the right way. The chain of logic was inexorable, and it led, inevitably, toward a single, final conclusion. The ancient forebears of the wizards, thousands of years earlier, had told the source of magic to only levitate things if you said, Wingardium Leviosa. Harry slumped over the breakfast table, resting his forehead wearily on his right hand. There was a story from the dawn days of artificial intelligence, back when they were just starting out and no one had yet realized the problem would be difficult, about a professor who had delegated one of his grad students to solve the problem of computer vision. Harry was beginning to understand how that grad student must have felt. This could take a while. Why did it take more effort to cast the Alohomora spell if it was just like pressing a button? who'd been silly enough to build in a spell for Avada Kedavra that could only be cast using hatred? Why did wordless transfiguration require you to make a complete mental separation between the concept of form and concept of material? Harry might not be done with this problem by the time he graduated Hogwarts. He could still be working on this problem when he was 30 years old. Harry hadn't realized that on a gut level before. He'd just given an inspiring speech about determination. Harry's mind briefly considered whether to get on a gut level that he might never solve the problem at all, then decided that would be taking things much too far. Besides, so long as he could get as far as immortality in the first few decades, he'd be fine. What method had the Dark Lord used? Come to think of it, the fact that the Dark Lord had somehow managed to survive the death of his first body was almost infinitely more important than the fact that he'd tried to take over magical Britain.
"Excuse me. At your convenience, Mr. Malfoy requests the favour of a conversation."
Harry did not choke on his breakfast cereal. Instead, he turned around and beheld Mr. Crabbe.
"Excuse me," said Harry. "Don't you mean the boss wants to talk with yous?"
Mr. Crabbe didn't look happy.
"Mr. Malfoy instructed me to speak properly."
"I can't hear you," Harry said. "You're not speaking properly."
He turned back to his bowl of tiny blue crystal snowflakes and deliberately ate another spoonful.
"The boss wants to talk with yous,"
came a threatening voice from behind him.
"You'd better come see him if you know what's good for you."
There. Now everything was going according to plan. Act 1.
"Our reason," said the old wizard.
He restrained the fury from his face. The boy before him had been the victim, and certainly didn't need to be frightened any further.
"There is nothing that can excuse..."
"What I did to him was worse."
The old wizard stiffened in sudden horror.
"Harry, what have you done?"
I tricked Draco into believing that I'd tricked him into participating in a ritual that sacrificed his belief in blood purism, and that meant he couldn't be a Death Eater when he grew up. He'd lost everything, Headmaster."
There was a long quiet in the office, broken only by the tiny puffs and whistles of the fiddly things, which, after enough time, had come to seem like silence.
"Dear me," said the old wizard, "I do feel silly, and here I was expecting you might try to redeem the heir of Malfoy by, say, showing him true friendship and kindness."
"Ha! Yeah, like that would have worked."
The old wizard sighed. This was taking it too far.
"Tell me, Harry, did it ever occur to you that there was something incongruous about setting out to redeem someone through lies and trickery?"
"I did it without telling any direct lies, and since we're talking about Draco Malfoy here, I think the word you're looking for is congruous."
The boy looked rather smug. The old wizard shook his head in despair.
"And this is the hero we're all doomed."
Act 5. The long, narrow tunnel of rough stone, unlit except by a child's wand, seemed to stretch on for miles. The reason for this was simple. It did stretch on for miles. The time was 3 in the morning, and Fred and George were starting the long way down the secret passage that led from a statue of a one-eyed witch in Hogwarts to the cellar of the Honeyduke's candy shop in Hogsmeade.
"How's it going?" said Fred in a low voice. Not that there'd be anyone listening, but there was something odd about talking in a normal voice when you were going through a secret passage.
"Still on the fritz," said George. "Both, or intermittent one fixed itself again. Other one same as ever."
The map was an extraordinarily powerful artifact, capable of tracking every sentient being on the school grounds in real time by name. Almost certainly it had been created during the original raising of Hogwarts. It was not good that errors were starting to pop up. Chances were that no one except Dumbledore could fix it if it was broken. And the Weasley twins weren't about to turn the map over to Dumbledore. It would have been an unforgivable insult to the Marauders, the four unknowns who'd managed to steal part of the Hogwarts security system, something probably forged by Salazar Slytherin himself, and twist it into a tool for student pranking. Some might have considered it disrespectful. Some might have considered it criminal. The Weasley twins firmly believed that if Godric Gryffindor had been around to see it, he would have approved. The brothers walked on, and on, mostly in silence. The Weasley twins talked to each other when they were thinking through new pranks, or when one of them knew something the other didn't. Otherwise, there wasn't much point. If they already knew the same information, they tended to think the same thoughts and make the same decisions. Back in the old days, whenever magical identical twins were born, it had been the custom to kill one of them after birth. In time, Fred and George clambered out into a dusty cellar, strewn with barrels and racks of strange ingredients. Fred and George waited. It wouldn't have been polite to do anything else. Before too long, a thin old man in black pyjamas clambered down the steps that led into the cellar, yawning.
"Hello, boys," said Ambrosius Flume. "I wasn't expecting you tonight. Out of stock already."
Fred and George decided that Fred would speak.
"Not exactly, Mr. Flume," said Fred. "We were hoping you could help us with something considerably more, interesting."
"Now, boys," said Flume, sounding severe. "I hope you didn't wake me up just so I could tell you again that I'm not selling you any merchandise that could get you into real trouble. Not until you're 16, anyways."
George drew forth an item from his robes and wordlessly passed it to Flume.
"Have you seen this?" said Fred.
Flume looked at yesterday's edition of the Daily Prophet and nodded, scowling. The headline on the paper read, "The Next Dark Lord," and showed a young boy which some student's camera had managed to catch in an uncharacteristically cold and grim expression.
"I can't believe that Malfoy," Flume snapped, "going after the boy when he's only 11. The man ought to be ground up and used to make chocolates."
Fred and George blinked in unison. Malfoy was behind Rita Skeeter? Harry Potter hadn't warned them about that, which surely meant that Harry didn't know. He never would have brought them in, if he did. Fred and George exchanged glances. Well, Harry didn't need to know until after the job was done.
"Mr. Flume," Fred said quietly, "the boy who lived needs your help."
Flume looked at them both. Then he let out his breath with a sigh.
"All right," said Flume. "What do you want?"
Act 6.
When Rita Skeeter was intent on a tasty prey, she didn't tend to notice the scurrying ants who constituted the rest of the universe, which was how she almost bumped into the balding young man who stepped into her pathway.
"Miss Skeeter,"
said the man, sounding rather severe and cold for someone whose face looked that young.
"Fancy running into you here."
"Out of my way, Buster,"
snapped Rita, and tried to step around him. The man in her pathway matched the movement so perfectly that it was like neither of them had moved at all, just stood still while the street shifted around them. Rita's eyes narrowed.
"Who do you think you are?"
"How very foolish," the man said dryly. "It would have been wise to memorize the face of the disguised Death Eater training Harry Potter to be the next Dark Lord. After all," a thin smile, "that certainly sounds like someone you wouldn't want to run into on the street, especially after doing a hatchet job on him in the newspaper."
Rita took a moment to place the reference. This was Quirinus Quirrell. He looked too young and too old at the same time. His face, if it relaxed from its severe and condescending pose, would belong to someone in his late 30s. And his hair was already falling out. Couldn't he afford a healer? No, that wasn't important. She had a time and a place and a beetle to be. She'd just received an anonymous tip about Madame Bones making time with one of her younger assistants. That would be worth quite a bonus if she could manage to verify it. Bones was high on the hit list. The tipster had said that Bones and her young assistant were due to eat lunch in a special room at Mary's place, a very popular room for certain purposes, a room which, she'd found, was secure against all listening devices, but not proof against a beautiful blue beetle nestled up against one wall.
"Out of my way,"
Rita said, and tried to push Quirrell from her path. Quirrell's arm brushed her own, deflecting, and Rita staggered as the thrust went into the thin air. Quirrell pulled up the sleeve on his left robe, showing his left arm.
"Observe," said Quirrell. "No dark mark. I would like your paper to publish a retraction."
Rita let out an incredulous laugh. Of course the man wasn't a real Death Eater. The paper wouldn't have published it if he was.
"Forget it, Buster. Now, take a hike."
Quirrell stared at her for a moment. Then he smiled.
"Miss Skeeter," said Quirrell, "I had hoped to find some lever that would prove persuasive. Yet I find that I cannot deny myself the pleasure of simply crushing you."
"It's been tried. Now get out my way, Buster, or I'll find some auras and have you arrested for obstruction of journalism."
Quirrell swept a small bow and then walked past.
"Goodbye, Rita Skeeter,"
said his voice from behind her. As Rita bowled on ahead, she noted in the back of her mind that the man was whistling a tune as he walked away. Like that would scare her.
Act 4.
"Sorry, count me out," said Lee Jordan. "I'm more the giant spider type."
The boy who lived had said that he had important work for the Order of Chaos. Something serious and secret, more significant and difficult than their usual run of pranks. And then Harry Potter had launched into a speech that was inspiring yet vague. a speech to the effect that Fred and George and Lee had tremendous potential if they could just learn to be weirder, to make people's lives surreal, instead of just surprising them with the equivalence of buckets of water propped above doors. Fred and George had exchanged interested looks. They'd never thought of that one. Harry Potter had invoked a picture of the prank they'd pulled on Neville, which Harry had mentioned with some remorse, the Sorting Hat had chewed him out on, but which must have made Neville doubt his own sanity. For Neville, it would have felt like being suddenly transported into an alternate universe. The same way everyone else had felt when they'd seen Snape apologize. That was the true power of pranking.
"Are you with me?"
Harry Potter had cried, and Lee Jordan had answered, "No."
"Count us in," said Fred,
or possibly George, for there was no doubt that Godric Gryffindor would have said yes. Lee Jordan gave a regretful grin and stood up and left the deserted, quieted corridor where the four members of the Order of Chaos had met and sat down in a conspiratorial circle. The three members of the Order of Chaos got down to business. It wasn't that sad. Fred and George would still work with Lee on giant spider pranks, same as ever. They'd only started calling it the Order of Chaos in order to recruit Harry Potter, after Ron had told them about Harry being weird and evil, and Fred and George had decided to save Harry by showing him true friendship and kindness. Thankfully, this no longer seemed necessary, although they weren't quite sure about that.
"So," said one of the twins, "what's this about?" "Rita Skeeter,"
said Harry.
"Do you know who she is?"
Fred and George nodded, frowning.
"She's been asking questions about me."
That wasn't good news.
"Can you guess what I want you to do?"
Fred and George looked at each other, a bit puzzled.
"You want us to slip her some of our more interesting candies?" "No,"
said Harry.
"No, no, no. That's giant spider thinking. Come on. What would you do if you heard that Rita Skeeter was looking for rumours about you?"
That made it obvious. Grins slowly started on the faces of Fred and George.
"Start rumours about ourselves," they replied. "Exactly,"
said Harry, grinning widely.
"But these can't just be any rumours. I want to teach people never to believe what the newspaper says about Harry Potter, any more than muggles believe what the newspaper says about Elvis. At first, I just thought about flooding Rita Skeeter with so many rumours that she wouldn't know what to believe. But then she'll just cherry-pick the ones that sound plausible and bad. So, what I want you to do is create a fake story about me and get Rita Skeeter to believe it, somehow. But it has to be something that afterward everyone will know is fake. We want to fool Rita Skeeter and her editors and afterward have the proof come out that it was false. And of course, given that those are the requirements, the story has to be as ridiculous as it can possibly be, and still get printed. Do you understand what I want you to do?"
"Not exactly,"
Fred and George said slowly.
"You want us to invent the story?" "I want you to do all of it,"
Harry Potter said.
"I'm sort of busy right now. Plus, I want to be able to say truthfully that I had no idea what was coming. Surprise me."
For a moment, there was a very evil grin on the faces of Fred and George. Then they turned serious.
"But, Harry,
We don't really know how to do anything like that.
So, figure it out, Harry said. I have confidence in you. Not total confidence, but if you can't do it, tell me that, and I'll try someone else, or do it myself. If you have a really good idea, for both the ridiculous story and how to convince Rita Skeeter and her editors to print it, then you can go ahead and do it. But don't go with something mediocre. If you can't come up with something awesome, just say so.
Fred and George exchanged worried glances.
I can't think of anything, said George. Neither can I, said Fred. Sorry.
Harry stared at them. And then Harry began to explain how you went about thinking of things. It had been known to take longer than 2 seconds, said Harry. You never called any question impossible, said Harry, until you had taken an actual clock and thought about it for 5 minutes. By the motion of the minute hand, not 5 minutes metaphorically, 5 minutes by a physical clock. And, furthermore, Harry said, his voice emphatic and his right hand thumping hard on the floor, you did not start out immediately looking for solutions. Harry then launched into an explanation of a test done by someone named Norman Mayer, who was something called an organizational psychologist, and who'd asked 2 different sets of problem-solving groups to tackle a problem. The problem, Harry said, had involved 3 employees doing 3 jobs. The junior employee wanted to just do the easiest job. The senior employee wanted to rotate between jobs to avoid boredom. An efficiency expert had recommended giving the junior person the easiest job and the senior person the hardest job, which would be 20% more productive. 1 set of problem-solving groups had been given the instructions. Do not propose solutions until the problem has been discussed as thoroughly as possible without suggesting any. The other set of problem-solving groups had been given no instructions. And those people had done the natural thing and reacted to the presence of a problem by proposing solutions. And people had gotten attached to those solutions and started fighting about them and arguing about the relative importance of freedom versus efficiency and so on. The 1st set of problem-solving groups, the ones given instructions to discuss the problem first and then solve it, had been far more likely to hit upon the solution of letting the junior employee keep the easiest job and rotating the other 2 people between the other 2 jobs, for what the expert data said would be a 19% improvement. Starting out by looking for solutions was taking things entirely out of order, like starting a meal with dessert, only bad. Harry also quoted someone named Robin Dawes as saying that the harder a problem was, the more likely people were to try to solve it immediately. So, Harry was going to leave this problem to Fred and George, and they would discuss all the aspects of it and brainstorm everything they thought might be remotely relevant. And they shouldn't try to come up with an actual solution until they'd finished doing that. Unless, of course, they did happen to randomly think of something awesome, in which case they could write it down for afterward, and then go back to thinking. And he didn't want to hear back from them about any so-called failures to think of anything for at least a week. Some people spent decades trying to think of things.
"Any questions?" said Harry.
Fred and George stared at each other.
"I can't think of any. Neither can I."
Harry coughed gently.
"You didn't ask about your budget."
Budget, they thought.
I could just tell you the amount,
Harry said,
but I think this will be more inspiring.
Harry's hands dipped into his robe and brought forth... Fred and George almost fell over, even though they were sitting down.
Don't spend it for the sake of spending it,
Harry said. On the stone floor in front of them gleamed an absolutely ridiculous amount of money.
Only spend it if awesomeness requires, and what awesomeness does require, don't hesitate to spend. If there's anything left over, just return it afterward. I trust you. Oh, and you get 10% of what's there, regardless of how much you end up spending.
We can't,
blurted one of the twins.
We don't accept money for that sort of thing.
The twins never took money for doing anything illegal. Unknown to Ambrosius Flume, they were selling all of his merchandise at 0% markup. Fred and George wanted to be able to testify, under Veritaserum if necessary, that they had not been profiteering criminals, just providing a public service. Harry frowned at them.
But I'm asking you to put in some real work here. A grown-up would get paid for doing something like this, and it would still count as a favour for a friend. You can't just hire people for this sort of thing.
Fred and George shook their heads.
Fine, Harry said. I'll just get you expensive Christmas presents, and if you try returning them to me, I'll burn them. Now